Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Rima Katz. Today, we're going to dive into a topic that has been top of mind for many banks, merchants, and financial institutions. We're going to talk about real-time payments. Joining us today is Rodrigo Figueroa, Chief Operating Officer of Chargeback Gurus, along with our own Brian Riley, Director of Credit and Co-Head of Payments at Mercator Advisory Group. They discuss the current RTP landscape, what it looks like in the U.S. as well as in other regions around the globe, and dive into what we can expect in the space in 2023. Rodrigo and Brian, it's great to have you with us today. Rodrigo, this may be a bit broad, but I'd like to set the stage a bit when we talk about such a significant topic. In the simplest of definitions, what are real-time payments?
Real-time payments is, you know, what the statement already says, right? These are transactions that are initiated, processed, settled. But most importantly, right, when we think about transactions, we need to think in terms of ledgers. Each bank has a ledger. And what happens is you want to make sure that, you know, when you actually have a debit on bank A, that the same transaction will be reflected on bank B, where the money is going. And what real-time payments allows this to happen is really that these ledgers are updated in real-time as well. So it's not only the element of the consumer that realizes on both sides, right, where you actually have transaction, you know, being really seen, you know, the confirmation of the credit or debit on your account in real time. But the banks on the back end will also have pretty much recorded and settled and the transaction on their ledgers in real time as well. And this is why it's so cool, right? Because it really eliminates a lot of risk from a credit perspective, from a settlement perspective into the ecosystem.
No, it's not without its challenges, right? Because one of the issues is that they come in and they are at final settlement once they clear. Right. Yeah. So that creates a whole different scenario. And you know, if this was just on a payment card, there's a somewhat of a built-in delay there to let that process, if there's a charge back, for instance, or if it's sent an error. But that's one of the challenges you even see in the early market on this, right, is that consumers have uneven coverage under things like Reg E in the U.S.
Oh, exactly. Couldn't agree more. Let's start just with the behavioral elements of these, right? I think from a behavioral perspective, you know, we are getting used to everything being in real time, right? You want your food as fast as you can. You want to make sure the transactions are, they're observing this happening actually in your account in real time. So this is not coming out of nowhere, right? As a matter of fact, there were very clear elements that forced countries to move in this direction simply because this is how society was evolving for the type of, you know, of transaction that you want to see in the environment where you actually have counterparts trading, negotiating, buying, selling. The expectation that you will actually be able to settle transactions in real time became almost, omnipresent. It's something that everybody expects nowadays because technology can support it. And as I said, if you are really sitting, you know, on one of the ends of these transactions, it eliminates a lot of risk for you. Although, not to say that, you know, it's risk-free, quite the opposite, right, to your point, right? You really create a different set of risks that need to be managed accordingly. And we have seen in some markets, the ecosystems stumbling a little bit, especially on the elements of transactional risk, where you actually see fraud spiking up very, very early. They don't know how to handle it in the early stages because you don't just have data to be able to identify, you know, what is good, what is bad. And of course, it gets better over time. But yeah, it's quite costly at the beginning when you actually do those transitions for the reason that you just laid out, right? These are, in any market where you actually see this, you know, being initiated, there is a learning curve and there are elements and it will actually cost in terms of risk because of these elements that, you know, it's just the unknown, right? I do remember talking to my peers, you know, in the European markets, in the UK, when they actually implemented faster payments. And it was just fascinating to see what actually happened in those environments. You would actually see literally money being distributed across different accounts, stolen money, right, in different accounts in a matter of minutes. It would be already be on like layer 4 or layer 5 of that, you know, of that cycle. 6-7 transactions later in the same day, there was no way for you to be able to track these things. So while it, again, right, I'm up, all up for it. I think it really unlocks a lot of value in any economy, in any ecosystem. But there are elements that you need to address very early because transactional risks, specifically fraud, can become quite costly for the whole ecosystem.
Sure. And one thing you find with payments too is the easier you make it for consumers to live, the easier you have a change in the environment for crooks to take advantage of it, right? So you have one facet of it where you really have to govern the user in a good situation, right, that's happening. But then when you have somebody who's got a nefarious action here that wants to attack the system, you're also now operating in an area with less control that's really not been proven over time. And that's something that really makes it interesting to me.
Oh, exactly. I couldn't agree more. And then the question is, and you see actually, culturally speaking, you find the different equilibriums there, right? What is the right balance? You will look in Europe, right, where I would say they're probably much more friendly towards government intervention into these networks and really top-down rules that actually come in order to create protection. This is why you actually see that, you know, in Europe through PSD2, you know, some very strict rules in terms of how you do authentication. And they accept it, right? They actually accept to secure much more than in the US. For this reason, the culture matters in that sense, and actually it is expected from those markets. In the US, sometimes you could almost claim it's a little bit quite the opposite, right? The convenience matters more. So the point is, make it easy, accessible, and then you kind of pick up the risks on the back end, and that's quite costly. In the end of the day, it's quite interesting, right? Because you have externalities coming from both those two scenarios, those two environments. I think in Europe, you end up creating a little bit of a scenario where, you know, it's there is attrition for you to actually get into the ecosystem, right? And in the US, you know, you just pretty much pay for it on the back end through costs associated with fraud, as an example, that eventually go back into the ecosystem, right? Because somehow this has to be reverted in some sort of fee or anything to make the platform, the ecosystem, a little bit safer. But it really depends on, you know, where you're looking at in the world, and they will actually find different responses to that.
Sure. In your European example, that PSD, the D stands for directives, right?
Exactly.
This is how it's going to be done, and you have to follow it, and there's clear rules associated with it.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And look, we're talking about two markets here that are quite developed in that sense, right? When we talk about real-time payments, the area where I really love to look at is, you know, emerging developing economies. You look at what happened with M-Pesa in Kenya. Actually, it's a little bit more broad right today, right? Because it's actually several countries in the African continent have actually adopted similar processes. You went from an economy, right, that literally had nothing, and all of a sudden they're one of the most digitized in the whole world, and really has unlocked so much value for that economy. And even at the personal level, right, when you actually hear the stories about how smaller villages were able to start trading, to sell their products in a much safer way, it's just fascinating. And that's really the true value in it, right? Because I think in the US or in Europe, we talk about it, you know, yeah, it's coming, but it's almost like a substitute for something that we have. Of course, in the US, we talk about, you know, you have the big networks, the card networks. So it's almost like, you know, you're eating market from one or another. But when you actually look at real-time payments in markets in emerging economies, like, you know, in Africa, another example, for example, that I'm quite familiar with, just because my family is from, it's Brazil. They implemented PIX just a couple of years ago, and did you not, right? They went from zero to becoming pretty much somewhere around 40 to 50% of all of the transactions in that market in less than a year, right? If you are in Brazil, and I'm actually going to be heading there soon for the holidays, you can actually buy a pizza and really do a real-time payment sometimes through your, you know, text messaging, right, WhatsApp. And that's actually the preferred method for payments in some of those markets right now. So this element of unlocking value, especially in these emerging economies, I just find it fascinating. And sometimes I think it brings more value to them sometimes than to more established, developed economies like in the US, because we had somehow some alternatives here, good or bad, they exist, right?
Well, you know, I like the example about Kenya, and my response to that's always, you're going from hundreds of thousands of transactions there to billions of transactions here. So there's a whole different play. And yeah, you look at Africa, and the whole continent of Africa is similar in transaction volume to the state of New Jersey in the US, right? And there's 50 states. But your Brazilian example is really interesting too, because there you have volume, right? It's a country that's had tons of debit transactions. It's primarily debit. You know, when I look at that market, it does have a play in credit, but that's a different value prop in Latin America. But debit is sure big there, and volumes are very close to where the US volumes are going.
Exactly, exactly. And to your point, I think it's very fair, right? The US somehow always had a different ecosystem, right? Look at the size of the banks. Look at, actually how many banks you have in any economy, right? If you look at Latin America, any country, to your point, right? Some of these economies in Africa, they're smaller than, the states in the US. But even in Europe, right, you have a lot of consolidation, right? You usually see, a handful or maybe just a dozen of banks that dominate 99% of those markets, right? In the US, last time I counted, please correct me if I'm wrong here. In the US, it's such a distributed environment. We're still dealing with more than 4,000 banks, more than 4,000 different, participants in the ecosystem. How do you create, a cohesion among that, right? It takes time. This is why I think you actually see some of these adoptions of new technologies in the US taking a little bit longer. And I don't think it's good or bad, right? It's just, because the US is a different animal in that sense. But I kind of like it, right? In that sense, the US gets the benefit of actually looking at what the other places on earth did and absorb the good, the bad, and really come up with something much better. It takes longer, but in the end of the day, I think it's a more refined product anyway. And to the element that you brought earlier, the US, I always find these solutions to be much more convenient than in some other places on earth. I'll give you another example. I was in India just a couple of, last month, and I tried to buy a ticket, an airline ticket, which, you would assume that it is something, there's nothing more global than buying an airline ticket, right? Because people travel everywhere. So you would expect that, you're going to put your card there, even in an Indian site, and it's going to recognize that it is an international card and approve the transaction. I could not do it. It would not accept my card. I tried all of them. I tried the two different rails that they actually had. They actually had a rail for international transactions, and yet it got declined. So this is my point about convenience, right? Some of these markets, they're gonna go for security versus convenience. And in the US, I think it's exactly the opposite.
You gave some really great use cases, and similar to what Brian said, the one about Brazil in terms of how to pay for pizza kind of really stood out. For those not familiar with it, can you give us a bit of a breakdown, in terms of how do real-time payments work? And I'm sure it does differ depending on where you are.
Yeah. And look, fact is, even in the US, good chunk of the users, they're not going to be completely oblivious to that, right? Real-time payments is not new in the sense that it actually exists for a couple of years, but we actually had some closed-loop networks that tried to create the same effect of a real-time payment, right? I will let you refer to my previous employer, PayPal. They own, of course, Venmo, which is actually a very successful P2P network that exists in the US, where you can literally, and to your point, how does it work? It's as simple as you recognize it, right? You have, your phone or, actually for Venmo, it's just your phone, but, it would work, of course, in any online environment where you're going to send, money. You're going to pretty much, put the value, interesting, right? What I love the concept of real-time payments as well, that it's kind of embedding the idea of what your key is in terms of identity, right? It doesn't have to be your account anymore, right? It can be just your cell phone. It can be, and your email identifier. As a risk professional, sometimes I'm not necessarily fond of it because it just creates another, avenue and vectors for, for abuse. However, it makes it incredibly convenient in the sense that, that token, that identity becomes the way you can actually, you are associated within that ecosystem. So you're going to press the send button and, those values, those monies get automatically transferred to another part of the network. And of course, I was mentioning Venmo earlier. The fact is, when you actually look at what RTP does in some other open loop networks in the US, and you would actually say the clearinghouse, of course, has probably the closest to, what we're talking about here now, which is open, but FedNow is also coming. But you also have Zelle, right, which somehow it is open loop in the sense that all of the banks also participate. That transaction will literally move from bank A to bank B and will be recognized by the receiver of the transaction not necessarily real time, right? Because, I don't think it will be a matter of seconds, but it will be a matter of minutes sometimes. So near real time is as good as it gets in terms of the recognition of the transaction, and pretty much settlement between the two sides. And as I was saying earlier, right, it's not just the recognition of the payment from, a consumer perspective, vision of the payment. the settlement actually of those monies happen in real time between those banks as well, right? This is what this is how they work. There are nuances here or there that you will actually see some, you know, in some markets, those settlements between the banks will happen overnight. But fact is, these things are already embedded into their, you know, liquidity models and everything, just to make sure that, you know, pretty much the moment you actually receive the money on your side, that's a confirmed transaction and it cannot be reversed, which, by the way, brings elements of risk as well. Right. We were talking a little bit the element of fraud, which, you know, can become quite acute in some of these ecosystems. But the other element that matters for me a lot and kind of, you know, it's front and center for what we do here in Chargeback Goods on a daily basis. Right. Dispute management. Right. I look at that in Brazil, you know, as I was giving you this example earlier, you know, you're paying for that pizza literally through a text right now. And what happens if you don't like the pizza or that pizza never arrives, right? There is not an easy mechanism for you to reverse the transaction. If anything, the way I like to look at it, when you look at the existing card networks and pretty much, you know, of course, the ones that we all know, MasterCard, Visa, but also Amex and Discover, from a protection perspective, you can actually look at it, you know, a lot of the protections, like, you know, they're very focused on the consumer. On these early stages of these P2P networks, what actually happens, you transfer a lot of that power to the merchant side, right? Because there's not an easy way for you to actually dispute or challenge the transaction. The monies are gone. They are gone. So unless you're not dealing with a bona fide, you know, part on the other, you know, a counterpart on the other side that recognizes that maybe the service wasn't delivered, that there was, you know, something that really wasn't as expected, you know, if they don't actually initiate a transaction to reverse that, there are no mechanisms in most of the world, by the way, this is actually a problem that's happening everywhere in order to satisfy that element of dispute. And that is a problem, right? Because it can generate dissatisfaction in the way that maybe for commerce, look, fact is there are a lot of different use cases for payment, you know, for real-time payments, right? You can pay your bills and everything. For those, of course, you know, probably these scenarios I'm talking about here are less important. But when you're talking about true commerce, and you will deal with the element of disputes, right? Because, you know, it's just inherent into these interfaces. What will happen is if you do this once and you have a bad experience, you might not be keen to be using this, you know, this method, this rail anymore. And this is where I think really the networks, the MasterCard and Visas of the world excel, because they actually provide those mechanisms and you feel incredibly comfortable using your card for that reason, because you know that if there's anything here that happens that you don't like, right, about the transaction, maybe sometimes a little bit too much, right? But, you know, there are mechanisms you can actually engage in order to satisfy and really, you know, make the right, from your perspective as the consumer, right, get some sort of resolution into that dispute. And this is something that I think that eventually it will evolve on these P2P networks, but I don't feel it's just there yet.
You know, Rodrigo, you brought up something really interesting, and it boils down to a foundational aspect of banking that goes 200 years back or 300 years back, and that's on-us and off-us transactions. Right? On-us means that I've got both of the counterparties on my bank. Office means I've only got one of the counterparties. And that's one of the brilliance of MasterCard and Visa's design originally when they launched, because they fundamentally take a universal set of customers and they have a universal match of merchants and they act as the intermediary for clearance. So if I have an account at Lloyds Bank in London and you have an account at Citibank in New York, they can sort all that out. Now, that becomes a risk as we start getting into faster payments, right? Because you have that to deal with. But that's a really important piece that affects the whole ecosystem.
Oh, yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. Don't you love, remember those movies? I think Swordfish was one of them, right? Where a bubble is fascinating. And if you're not in the banking industry, right, you're thinking that this is the reality because this movie is 20 years old, where, to your point, they were moving money from, and I don't remember anymore, but just give an example, right, from New York to London, from London to Istanbul, from Istanbul to Hong Kong, from Hong Kong to Shanghai. It doesn't work that way. As a matter of fact, and by the way, it's something that you brought up that which is important to mention here, right? As good as these networks are becoming and as mature as they're becoming, they're still encapsulated within their own nationalities, right? So RTP in the US through the, you know, through the Clearing House and eventually FedNow, or faster payments in the UK, PIX in Brazil, they operate incredibly well, but they are really encapsulated within that environment, that banking environment that exists in that country. We haven't really seen yet the next generation, which I think eventually pops up, right, which is interconnectivity, interoperability between markets, between, you know, countries. Bitcoin was the one that was going to solve for that, right? A little bit. One ledger that really communicates communicates globally, and the transaction is settled, and it sits on the ledger, and everybody can see. So it's not disputed. And I'm not going to get there because, I mean, you know, we're talking about the crypto winter, but I'm just talking about the functionality in itself, which I find fascinating. But that would be the challenge, right? To your point, we have created, I think, excellent rails, despite the fact that we still need to address the elements of how you actually do disputes, how you actually, you know, make sure that there is, you know, an egalitarian system in terms of, you know, who's actually handling the risk on each side. But to your point, moving into allowing these networks eventually to talk to each other internationally, I think it's going to take a little bit longer, of course. But yes, it's something that eventually will happen, right? The market demands, trade demands it, and it will be fun when it actually exists. And then again, right, when we cross that bridge, we're going to see other types of risks arising. We're going to have to, you know, be very careful, because now we're not only dealing with, you know, like separate banks, right, but separate banks that operate in different jurisdictions that have different laws and all of these elements that will actually bring a completely new set of complexities and risks that will need to be managed.
Yeah, there's a real-time challenge with that now with domestic payment schemes, right? So it's one thing to have a Visa, MasterCard branded debit card, and you can usually work your way in a different country with that. But if you try taking a Mir card, for example, in India, you can't use that. Unless it's got a MasterCard Visa brand on it, it doesn't necessarily have the acceptance. Now, you might think, and there might be bilateral arrangements, but you don't have that peace of mind that I only need one card in my pocket.
Oh, exactly. No, and look, this is the reason why still, right? You gotta give it to, you know, these amazing network schemes that really have global reach. Because to your point, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I was in India a couple of weeks ago. It just gives you such peace of mind. Hey, you know what? I have this piece of plastic here or this piece of metal, and it's going to be accepted in the hotels I go, in the restaurants I go. It really is, you know, a true global network in that sense. And this is something, as I said, that in my opinion, there is still a lot of legwork to be done to get to the same level of functionality.
The RTP space is still a bit of a like a work in progress, but I'm sure there are many benefits to real-time payments as well. Rodrigo, can you speak to some of the benefits that you're seeing?
Of course. And we kind of covered a little bit that earlier, right? From a societal perspective, we see changes in behaviors, right? As I said, that element of, you know, like instant gratification, it becomes so important right now, right? Because everything is on your phone, you know, two clicks away, a swipe sometimes. And for payments, it shouldn't be any different. Think about the gig economy, right? Where you're literally ordering whatever you want to do, your grocery, your shopping, your, you know, your food. You have a contingent of folks that actually, you know, pretty much enable those networks to function, the service providers. I do remember my early days at the bank, or even, you know, with PayPal. How do you make sure that, you know, that the service that they are providing, you know, that they're actually receiving those monies in time that, you know, makes sense for this type of service. We're talking about folks that are just getting into the market sometimes. For them, cash flow matters, right? It's not like they can actually wait for a month to get a check. Sometimes, by the way, those folks will not even have a checking account. So how do you create rails? How do you create capabilities where you can actually distribute to those funds in a way that it's fair and consistent, you know, for that ecosystem? And RTP networks help a lot, right? Because usually what you actually see is that, you know, the cost of, you know, for you know, for those transactions, it's less. So it's less onerous on those folks. And secondarily, you can actually do that with much more frequency. So you're not actually impacting their cash flow and in any negative way. So this is one way you can actually think about it. Bill payment, right? I have to say, I know I am an immigrant to this country. You can probably notice that on my accent. And I still remember, you know, and by the way, being 20 years here, and I found it 20 years ago that actually inconceivable that I actually had to write a check to pay for a bill, right? And that was 20 years ago, because from the market I was coming, that wasn't the case anymore already, Brazil in that case. And up to this day, right, it still happens. As a matter of fact, because of all of these different layers of security and attrition that we actually put in a lot of these networks, check fraud is actually increasing in the market right now, right, in the U.S. for this reason. So we never got, like, in the U.S., it's funny, right, because you keep on adding these new layers, these new capabilities, these new networks, these new ecosystems, but we never really get rid of everything, like the most, you know, the less used ones, the less technological ones, checks being the example. But really, imagine that, right? You can just send money and recognize, you know, that the confirmation of that transaction in a matter of minutes, or you can actually send a check, and sometimes can take all the way to 72 hours to settle. If you are, you know, if you are actually a, you know, a utility provider, that's, you know, it is a problem, right? It is actually expensive because you need folks on the other side that need to be opening envelopes, if you think about it, right? The most mundane of things still need to happen in order to, you know, pretty much receive those monies. Real-time payments decreases the cost for all of that from two perspectives, right? Because there are operational expenses associated with that directly, and there is the element of risk that you can actually pretty much also, you know, mitigate heavily when you enable this type of network. So in that sense, it helps a lot in all of these elements that are associated with bill payment as well. And the thing that we talked, you know, you can look at it as a bug or as a feature in the system, is the fact that they usually, those networks operate with payments that are irrevocable, right? You cannot reverse them. So you have to make sure that you're dealing with a legitimate party on the other side. Otherwise, you're going to have serious problems with that. So in one hand, it serves an important purpose because I think, you know, it really balances a little bit more the ecosystem in terms of risk. But on the other, as I said, when you're actually dealing with disputes, it, for legitimate reasons, right, where actually the two parties are legit, it can create a problem because there's no, and to your point you're making earlier, right, Brian, there's no one in the middle here that can actually be the arbiter for these things and make sure that you're actually making the right decision to satisfy those disputes. It's something that we think long and hard here at the company, right? Today, of course, we're very focused in supporting our clients that are in, you know, accepting card payments, but we are, you know, we see the evolution of our company, and, you know, how can we actually extrapolate from what we do today and really move to a scenario where we can actually help a lot of these markets and actually discuss what should be the policy when we actually discuss dispute management?
Have particular expertise in, and it's important to note because you think of all the different verticals. I probably will never have a dispute with my dry cleaner unless that maybe they burn a shirt when they're ironing it, right? But just block and tackle never ever happen. If I go on to a gambling site, that has a whole different layer of chargebacks that have to be dealt with, or into different, you know, I have a service man working on my lawn. What happens if there's a fault there? And how do I get that back? So that's going to be something really interesting. The first thing to look at here, I think, from an industry side, is how the regulations are going to develop, right? The whole Zelle issue, right? Zelle's very well intentioned, but there's some details that lack. But the other is the nuances of how you do need a recovery mechanism for these, but and it's going to vary drastically by location. I mean, the tons of analytics you have that you can go through is, you know, is there a regional difference? Do merchants in the country act different than merchants in the city? And then how do they stratify by what they do for the money they transact?
Oh, exactly. Look, I by the way, you gave this example, right, about gambling sites. The U.S. is just moving to this space right now, right? In Europe, in Asia Pacific, in places like Australia, gambling as an industry is much more established, has always been. And I could tell you, we have seen like the most sophisticated and amazing schemes where the gambling sites are actually the victim. And they are literally playing with those elements of, you know, consumer protection in those markets. So they will gamble and then they will literally cancel the transaction later. And because consumer laws are incredibly stringent, they win. And then because, of course, if you are a gambling site, right, probably you're not the most, you know, well seen into the ecosystem. So, you know, you have very little recourse in the situations. So to your point, there will be so many different scenarios here, so many different ways we can accept from the most low risk ones. No one cares. Actually, it's incredibly beneficial to the ecosystem. But then there will be some cases that can get super complicated, very fast, right? And as we were talking a little bit earlier, these networks, these real-time payment networks, they have not matured enough yet to consider what those scenarios are and what the rules will be in order for you to satisfy these elements of dispute yet. And I worry, because you know what will happen, right? We're not going to be addressing these issues proactively. right? What will happen is that we will actually see use cases being played into these ecosystems that no one ever thought about, and we'll just create a lot of noise because of disputes. And then we're going to have to retroactively look at these and say, okay, yes, we're going to have to do something about it. But it will generate a lot of noise, a lot of churn before we actually address these elements. And that has been the case in pretty much every market that went through this, right? And we'll just give you some of these examples again. M-Pesa, Pix in Brazil, they've been a couple of years into this already, and they don't actually have good dispute, you know, policies or processes in place yet.
That's one of the fun things about payments. You know, billions can be a rounding error in this business, right? And you start thinking about subscription management just as an item.
Oh, wow.
That didn't even exist 8 years ago. And now it's got, you know, on its way to $1 trillion in transactions just because it works so well. You look at embedded finance. I have a McDonald's app with a link to my Apple card, and it goes through like that. And all of a sudden, the volumes go from nothing to billions and billions and billions. And
exactly. We used to call it card on file, right? And now it's subscription. we were talking about this element of the evolution, right, of how society sees, you know, how they consume, what they want to consume, and especially in this element of pretty much, tell me, do you even know, by the way, how many services, digital services, do you subscribe? I have no idea. I can say off the top of my head, I have Netflix, I have Spotify, right, I have HBO Max. But, you know, I'm probably, there are other 10 that are not even thinking of those terms, and they're already there charging me, you know, and that's just the new natural, right? And every company in the world, of course, because they know that the moment they actually create some sort of subscription-based revenue embedded into their products, you know, they're going to be worth more money. That's simple.
$1.99 charge that sneaks
exactly. Exactly. So this is the new world, right? We're getting out of these like one-off type of situations, and everything will become some sort of subscription just because it is how we're getting incentivized to think in terms of consumption. And that changes, right? Because now, to your point, yes, there is a payment there, but remember that underlying that payment, there is a contract if it is a subscription, right? And that's really what matters when it comes to responsibilities on both sides. And how do dispute managements now will be, you know, embedded to address these elements of how these contracts are constructed will be super important, right? And again, right, when on the card side, you know, as a comparison, these issues disappear because there are very clear rules, there are bylaws, right? Everybody understands exactly what are your responsibilities when you're actually, you know, are doing a transaction. You're not signing that contract every time, you know, you're making a transaction, but you know you actually accept those terms and conditions. That is something that it's not as evolved yet, right? When you're just making a real-time payment right now, you're not thinking of those terms yet. And that will have to change.
And that's something the payments brand had to do with subscriptions recently is, you know, you have to be transparent in how you can undo this relationship. Because I've had the same thing happen. You have this little charge. You can't figure out how to get out of it. It's $1.99 to get out of it. And you don't have the time to figure it. And on page 6 of the website, they have the exit button, if they have it at all. Or you have to call a customer service number, sit on hold for an hour, and hope that it happens. So yeah. It's just an example of, you know, sometimes the technology gets ahead of the regulations on this. Right?
Oh, and exactly.
Over time, it will emerge. But, it, you know, going into this party, looking at all the risks, you know, what are the OFAC implications of this, right? Being able to take cross-border transactions, you've got a whole different world, and we haven't figured out even how, if we can recall the payment in a single jurisdiction, how complicated does it get as you cross time zones and international borders?
I couldn't agree more. I was thinking, isn't there a company out there that offers exactly that service? Like, if you give them your email ID, I guess, they will actually go and search for all of your subscription services and cancel them on your behalf. So it's so difficult that actually a company is monetizing the fact that, you know, they can actually do this in a simpler manner. I forgot the name of the company, but I remember seeing it, you know, somewhere on the web one of these days.
Well, my defense against this over the years has been on an annual basis, I'll go in and cancel some of my cards just because I sometimes forget what's in there. But now the banks are able to retain some of that information. So when they get when they reissue my card, my strategy doesn't work because they move over the transaction.
They do now, right? But look, fact is, because that feature exists already, right? That will, don't you believe this will be something that will easily be copied by these RTP networks, right? And it will be much harder because now your whatever is already is associated with a account number, right? It's not as easy to change an account number as it was easy to actually ask for a new card with a different PAN, right? So in my view, that element only gets harder from a consumer perspective because it will be easier to pull the money the moment you actually had, you know, signed to that agreement and you said, hey, you know what, I will buy this service for a year or 18 months or whatever it is.
Well, you know, and also you and I both worked at Citi. So we know that if you're going to call into a Citi call center, it's going to have an average speed of answer of 3 seconds across the world. Now try that on a government-driven site and see how, you know, try it with your taxes and see how quickly it takes them to pick up a call because it's nothing like calling in the top to your bank.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. But your point, right? So let me actually reverse the question here. Because of this reason, right? Because of this element of experience, customer service sometimes, you know, just can take forever. Look, post-pandemic, we're all seeing this issue with shortage of, you know, of staff, of people for the services economy that we run in this country. It's probably more of a global issue anyway. So it's much easier for you just to go into your app and just, you know, hey, you know, I'm going to charge back this transaction. I'm going to dispute this transaction, right? So sometimes a dealing with this happen outside of the payment network, right? It's something that you could actually address directly with the relationship that you had with that service provider, with that merchant. Now, because it's just so much more difficult to actually get access into that, to your point, sometimes you're going to have to spend hours on the phone to try to address that. If you know even where you have to address it, now they're just charging back all of these things, right? Because we incentivize that new behavior because of these horrible experiences that you can actually have on those, you know, when you're actually calling a call center nowadays. So to the point we're making earlier, right, there's no right or wrong here. In fact, is if, you know, these imbalances that happen in one side, they end up creating stresses downstream, right? And this is what we see in our company every day, right? A lot of the disputes we actually manage on behalf of our clients, they have nothing to do with fraud. They have nothing to do with, with misuse. Sometimes it's just someone that is disgruntled, and rather than trying to, you know, fix that, address that directly with the merchant, they go to the bank and say, hey, what, I did not do this transaction. I do not recognize this transaction. And it has become a problem for those merchants, right? And this is why we are here to support our clients. And this is what we do incredibly well. This is the reason for our existence, right? Because it has become a point, a pain point, and a pretty big one for a lot of merchants out there. And then again, right, as I said, as mature as the card networks are, these issues still exist. Right? It will not be any different, in my opinion, with any other type of rail, any other type of real-time payment network that it will exist out there. These elements of pressure will continue existing. And for now, it's worse because you don't actually have these policies, these processes to actually address those disputes just yet.
And I think the brands know this too, and there's been a lot to really simplify. You have your automatic adjudication process now and a lot of things, and the assumption is no longer the merchant's always wrong, right? Which has been a challenge. And even on the bank side, sometimes it's just easier to take the $5 hit and write it off than it is to spend all the hours involved. So really the re-engineering on this dispute process is something that's good for all parties, I think. And
yeah.
I think there have been some really strong improvements across the globe.
Oh, exactly. No, look, to your point, we want to believe that a lot of those, you know, dispute processes are automated on the back end, and it's not, right? It's actually thousands of people hired by the banks that are actually reviewing those cases and trying to make a, you know, a decision that it's fair and equitable in the ecosystem. It's not easy by any means. And then again, we're talking about a process on networks that have decades of experience. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is what worries me. And look, I don't mean to be negative. Quite the opposite. I love, you know, the evolution of this. If anything, you know, forces us to learn something new every day when you actually work in the payments industry. But I think we have to recognize that, you know, it will take time for these things to become more mature and really build all the broader elements, because it's not just the capability right in the ecosystem. You're going to have to build bylaws. You will have to actually explain what are the responsibilities for each party when you're actually using those networks. And this will take time. It's something new for consumers as well, right? Especially in the US. US, as I said. In some other markets, of course, they probably have more experience with that, but in the US, it will be something new. And the other element that I find super exciting, we don't even know what the use cases will be, right? We discussed, and you asked a little bit earlier that question, right? Some of these, you know, use cases are top of mind, of course, what we can do to support the gig economy, what we can actually do to support bill payment. The fact is, and as I said, right, I was, as I said, 2 years ago, I was in Brazil with my mom, and she said, let's order pizza. I'm like, yeah, of course. And I give her my cards. Like, I don't need a card. I can just make a payment with that. And I was like, and that was my mom, right? She's not the most tech savvy. And for her, it was like the most natural thing to send this payment through, you know, through her cell phone using that specific network called Pix there. It's just fascinating. I love it, right? Because it opens up so many different opportunities. And really engagement with different types of cohorts that sometimes have less access to technology or not. We just don't know what will happen there, right? But that's the fun part of it. And to be honest with you, you know, being in the payments industry for more than a decade, well, you know, close to a decade and a half now, and I still every day I learn something new. And this is what I love about it, truly, truly love about it.
As you mentioned, it comes down to that convenience aspect too. And I think convenience is going to be a really big driver going forward. You know, both of you spoke a lot about the current state of the real-time payments market, what's currently happening, even some tidbits of what we can expect. But let's imagine there's a crystal ball in front of you. You know, we're heading into 2023. Where do you see the space going? What can we expect?
You know, it's always the question that gets you in trouble. Look, different than other parts of the world, what I love about the U.S. goes back to the discussion we were having a little bit earlier. We already have, you know, RTP, you know, pretty much being supported by the clearinghouse. FedNow is coming and will come, of course, and I just assume, but I think everybody assumes the exact same thing, it will have massive impact, right? Because, of course, you know, its coverage and pretty much will force everybody to adopt those standards. But interesting enough, right, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I have not seen clear guidance of how the Fed will enable, FedNow will enable payments in general, especially for commerce yet, right? Still unclear how, you know, of course, the banks will have access, the acquirers for their own settlement will have access, but it's not clear to me it's still how we're going to go all the way to the last mile and allow consumers to have direct access so they can pretty much, you know, make it seamlessly part of their daily lives as an option for payments going forward. So I think there will be still policy discussions on that and in the end decide how, you know, the network will be made available to all the different participants in any given ecosystem. But then again, right, the US is different because we have competitors here, right? We talked about the clearinghouse, but you have Zelle as a good competitor. You have Venmo and, you know, and Cash App that are also competitors. Of course, it's closed loop, you know, but large closed loops, right? Because you have dozens of millions of people participating in those networks already. So the one thing I will say, because I don't know what will happen, right? It's like, it's not a given that just because it's the Fed doing something that it can become the standard, right? Because there is an element of usability, of convenience, of user interface that matters here as well, right? On my days of PayPal, when we're actually talking to and I was just in risk, right? But the product guys in Venmo, I was always fascinated, right? How they actually use user interfaces, you know, the element of the social media embedded into the network as well to attract more volume into those networks, right? People use Venmo. They really like to use Venmo for a reason, right? It's easy to use, great engagement, and these are very specific elements that matter to the product as well. Building the rails, right, and the infrastructure is one thing, but reaching the end consumer will be something completely different. And for this reason, it would not surprise me. And then again, it's not a prediction. I'm just saying that if really turns out that in the US we'll never have a standard just because you will actually have all these competitive, you know, networks operating in parallel, it would not be surprising if we actually end in, you know, in some setup like that. Because that's the history of the US, right? The US allows, it's such a big market that, you know, it allows for you to pretty much have all of these elements that compete with each other and allow them to still have enough scale that they can actually exist. So my take is, don't take it for granted that the US eventually will consolidate all of that in just one large network like it exists. And we gave these examples already, like Pix or M-Pesa in Kenya, right? The US can and maybe should absorb competition in this space and actually allow two or three different networks to operate in parallel. The key, and I don't know if we're ever going to move in the direction, right, will be like Europe did. Will there be interoperability between those networks, right? That's the question that I have no idea how we're going to actually solve for. Because if we move in that direction, then it's interesting, right? Because then you can imagine a scenario where, you know, there is a, you know, the center of that infrastructure, but then everybody can use it and you monetize it just because, you know, you have more people on your own network that connects to that, right? And you have to figure it out how you're going to be able to monetize that. But it could be a scenario where I could be using Venmo, somebody else will be using Cash App or, you know, FedNow, and they can communicate with each other. And then we're going to have to figure it out what the right, you know, business model will be for those. But we're all kind of communicating within one central pillar of a network, right?
See, that brings you back to honest office transactions. Do you start having a North American world or Oceania, and where does it all stop? And then you kind of have a network of networks. So
exactly. But we are years away from that, right? Definitely. If it ever happens, I have to say. In Europe, you can see that happening because, again, right, there are directives. They're really forcing this element of making pretty much the whole ecosystem omnipresent and equal for everyone. So if you are a citizen living in Europe, pretty much you kind of get the same time because it's the same rights, the same law. Right. Interoperability will be something in open banking will be something that really happens across there. In the US, we think differently, right? We like competition and that might be the way it works, right? We will actually allow these networks to compete with each other. And that's totally fine because we have scale for that.
Rodrigo and Brian, 2023 looks like it's going to be a great year for the real-time payment space with the launch of FedNow and the continued innovation and advancements that are happening worldwide. Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights and perspective. We hope to have you back on soon.